Age of Vision radio show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. Today we're going to be airing a pre-recorded interview that I did the very day that Sean McGee, our guest, started a vitriolic internet war with Dana Durnford for going after Dr. Busby and Dr. Caldicott. As many of you know, I don't condone either behavior. I have decided not to give up this interview since it is really valuable, brings us some good information. I do want to couch this by saying I don't condone it. I do hope that Dana Durnford returns to my radio show sometime. He's not very happy with the fact that I won't turn my back on Dr. Caldicott or Dr. Busby. But I also do not condone the behavior of Sean in regards to this YouTube internet fight. So I'm going to play the interview. I don't believe I'll have Sean back on until all of this vitriol has ended. I am not going to be party to it. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Please do get in touch with Sean if you want to find out more action about what he's taking a part in. And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the interview.
So thank you, Sean, for joining us.
Oh, sir, my pleasure, Lonnie. Nice to be.
Yes, I don't know if many of you know him, but Sean McGee is what we call an amateur science media journalist and researcher. I met him through really the YouTubes and Facebook. He posts really great articles about Fukushima and about the lies of the nuclear industry. He tries to give us accurate information. He writes for an online journal called the blog nuclearnews.org. I go there regularly to get .net. I go there regularly to get information. And thanks, Sean, for joining us.
Okay, well, I'll just refresh it. So nuclear-news.net. And I've been doing that. I'll just sort of introduce myself through that, I think. I was on Any News many, many years ago after the Fukushima disaster. And many of the posters on commenters on Any News were digging out, trying to find out what the hell was going on and what the nuclear industry is all about. And then I got offered, after a certain amount of time, I got offered a position in nuclear-news.net by Christina McPherson, who had been running that blog for about 8 years prior to Fukushima. And she, you know, had a very small sort of close-knit sort of community that were keeping an eye on it. She was very prolific, and she'd get, you know, 10 posts a day up, anything to do with nuclear or mining, uranium mining or anything in that sort of area. We sort of built up the, between the two of us, we built it up. I had a bit of social media skills, so I was able to share and let people know that the blog was there. our subscriptions increased, our daily hits increased. And you know, we've got pro nuclear people that go on it because they can't get that sort of information anywhere else. It's a nice central place they can go to find out the dirt in their industry. And of course, most of our people were basically sort of anti-nuclear. So they're scientists, they're reporters who were just checking up to see what was going on. And we basically just kept developing it. And during that time, I'd made contacts with journalists and scientists and other people. We'd basically started networking and sharing information. And that's kind of where I got to. I think after Fukushima as well, especially in the early days, I was sending information to sort of NGOs in Japan, like Green Action Japan, you know, anti-nuclear NGOs.
NGO.
That's non-governmental organization. Yeah. They were anti-nuclear group, should we say, and various other anti-nuclear groups and individuals in Japan. I was also involved with helping translate and disseminate Japanese information to the UK. I did that with one blogger called Tokyo Brown Tabby, who was chased off the internet by the Japanese government. And then a bit later on, I linked up with someone in England who was, you know, not a professional translator, but was able to get most of the information from the blogs and the Twitter feed and everything from Fukushima, and was actually had come from Fukushima and had family in Fukushima. So she would translate the information down to a certain point, but the English would be a bit rough, and I would come in and I would clean up the English, the grammar and everything. And then basically I would lay it out, and then I would promote it. You know, she had her blog, but it was a very small readership. But we would counter post all our stuff onto nuclear-news.net. So we have people from all over the world that actually link onto that blog. And we covered some stories that probably took 2 years or so before it came to the mainstream, even 3 years, about the rivers around there being radioactive and what have you, children born with polydactyl, that's an extra finger or an extra toe. Mm-hmm.
That's very common in Chernobyl also.
Yeah, well, it was for the first 7 years, and then it petered out, and it's probably going to be similar in Japan, where they'll have a rush of them. After 2 years, there was 100. There should have only been about 6 or 8, maybe 10. Should we say 10? But there was about at least 10.
Well, that's this generation. I mean, what does Dr. Caldicott say? It's really, you don't really start seeing it till 8 generations later. That's how long it really takes.
Yeah, at the end of the day, when we look at places like Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan, we see that these happened within a few generations, but that was quite a, you know, they had bombs going off, and they were just down the road from them, and they covered themselves with blankets, and things like this, and then they were studied by the Russians to see what the effects were, and now of course they have to have genetic passports, and they can't have children unless the government says they can.
What? I had not heard of that.
Yeah, no, that's a fact. So
that's in Russia.
That's in Kazakhstan. Well, it was part of Russia at the time. It's where Russia did some of their nuclear testing. They did some up nearer to Finland in the north as well.
So they're not allowed to have children unless the government says.
Well,
that's
the theory.
Children.
I mean, they do anyway, because what they do is they just run away, have the baby, and. There's a very famous film called After the Apocalypse, where this there was a family, they were quite badly disfigured, this young lady wanted to have a baby, and the doctor said, no, you can't, you know, you must have an abortion, and she went away, had a baby, and the baby was normal. So, you know, that's the thing about
and the babies. This is the hard part. The baby's normal this generation. See, this is what Dr. Goffman said this morning when I was reading this portion about human rights. He wrote that in his book on irreverie. I forget the title. The Irreverie History of Illustrated View of Nuclear Power, The Irreverie. He had this whole section about human rights and how this is murder. We are murdering millions of people. And it's not just, this is really a sick experiment. It is really unkind. It's so unconscionable.
Yeah.
Because we don't even see the worst cause of it all yet. You and I are going to be dead before the worst of these genetic mutations take shape.
Well, not in Kazakhstan, I'm afraid. But and there are other places as well where we see these. I mean, if you look at the court case in the UK, which was happening this year, it came after.
What do you mean not in Kazakhstan? What do you mean?
Well, that's Sami Palantis, where you can see these severe deformities. I mean, the UK scientists were, well, it was actually Professor Geraldine Thomas went to the screening of After the Apocalypse in London, and she took over the place from a geneticist, right? So she does thyroid cancer. And they didn't have any geneticists on there. And, of course, it was obvious that there's issues there. But she was saying, well, actually, what she said was, that it's because they smoke cigarettes and they drink alcohol. And then she went on about the facts, and this comes...
When was that? I think I remember hearing about this a couple of years ago.
Sure, I did. Just... I did an article on it, and...
I probably read your article.
Yeah. And, oh, it was crazy. And one thing...
It's been awesome, Sean. I'm so glad that you're joining us on the show, to be honest. It's really awesome because this is one of the things I talked to Carl Grossman this afternoon. I'm going to have him on my radio show. And I really want to address this thing about anti-nuke. The new anti-nuke movement is somewhat fragmented. There's a huge portion of people on YouTube. There's a lot of citizen journalists like you who have really there's a lot of people, several people, who have educated themselves on this issue and have their own YouTube channels and are doing really great work. And then there's this whole bitter backfighting, and part of it is that why I'm glad that you're on is you're a citizen journalist who is making his way. Like, you're an amateur science media journalist and researcher. You have done this because you're compelled, because of what happened, to find out the truth. And in doing so, you're becoming somewhat of a semi-expert. You haven't had the education, but you have the mentality where you really can understand the science of it all. That's how you're able to write these articles for these. You put it into simpler terms for people like me. Like when I recently read a scientific journal on my YouTube channel. Can I tell you the nuts and bolts of what was said? Probably not, but I got the general gist of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We need people to come together because we need millions and millions of people to understand how threatening this is to life on our planet and to stand up and demand an end to it and answers for the pollution it's already causing.
Well, I think, as citizens, as all of us as citizens of the world,
right.
We have to sort of rely on the information that's out there. And there is some information out there, and it's generally buried in quite technical documentation, and it's very hard to dig out. And if I might, I can give you two examples, actually, if you can give me a few
minutes. That would be awesome. Yeah,
yeah.
Let me see. We have 46 minutes, 45 minutes left, so.
Sure, right. Well, if you give me 5 minutes, I'll just quickly go through it. There was a story that was brought out in Science Daily. And what they were saying, basically, that Chernobyl's birds adapting to ionizing radiation, right? That was the headline. Mm-hmm. So you can see what's going on there. And that was in response to an article that Professor Timothy Massot did. Now, I read that and I thought, huh? And it didn't seem to tie in with what his actual study had done. So, but I wanted clarification. So I contacted him and, well, I just sent him an email, actually. And I said, look, what's this about the Science Daily saying that these birds are all adapting to ionizing radiation and giving the impression that everything's okay? So I basically contacted him. I explained it. He turned around and he actually did a rebuttal. So that was actually put up. So if he basically said, look, some birds, like the birds with black pigmentation, this is the simple version, the birds with black pigmentation, like crows, basically were able to adapt, right? But everything else, all the other diverse bird species, or, you know, quite a lot of them had disappeared. So what he was saying, and were suffering quite badly. But these crows, you know, because crows are pretty hard, aren't they, anyway? But they were able to adapt. But here's the but, which, you know, once again, Science Daily, you know, this is where you get your information from. They basically kind of ignored the fact that in this document, it was saying that these birds did it, but they did it at the expense of their evolutionary abilities. So the things that allow us to evolve, the chemicals in our body that allow us to evolve, basically were being used to protect the birds from radiation. So that's a great win for the pro-nuclears. The downside is that the birds were no longer able to evolve in that environment, in that radioactive environment. So that was it. That was where they were. Any changes to the climate, you know, in global warming terms or whatever, those birds were going to suffer because they wouldn't be able to adapt to the climate because those chemicals, I won't get technical on you, but those chemicals that would help them to adapt, you know, to a warmer or wetter or drier or whatever environment would be basically being used to protect them from radiation. That would, so therefore, you know, the idea that Chernobyl's birds adapting to ionizing radiation is a very blinkered view, right? So, and once again, it took myself just to send an email. You know, Science Daily could have sent the email and said, well, what do you reckon on this article? Do you agree with it? You know, they didn't. You know, that because there was a bit, you know, I think the term the headline I put on it was How to Spin a Radioactive Bird During Chernobyl Remembrance Day, which it was, using Google and Science Daily. Okay, so that was one. And I'll come to another one quickly, you know.
Well, they never take into account the harm to life. They only will talk about the things that things overcome.
I'll explain what that's about as well. So what I'll do, I'll give you the second example, and then I'll explain who's behind it, right? Now, that's the interesting thing. So the second one I did, I was on an article in Japan Times, which was about Dana Durnford, and they were saying that he was the main anti-nuclear activist and how evil he was. And then you got into the comments and the usual sort of pro-nuclear trolls. They're actual nuclear health physicists from USA would be in there, and they'd be going, yeah, he's out of order, blah blah blah. And, you know, to be honest, they would be picking apart his arguments in basic, you know, they didn't even have to break sweat. But then I started on them, and I was sort of saying, well, look, you know, there's a load of nuclear health physicists from a nuclear site that were involved in a knife fight where a load of people got killed, and they were actually Hell's Angels, you know. So, you know, you're saying that you're honest, and so we got into a big fight. And in the end, I then started mentioning the thyroid cancer cases. Now, this was about a year ago, wasn't it? You know, about that time. And so we got into the cancer cases, and they said that eventually they came up and said, well, his report is wrong because of this. And they gave me a list of six or eight things that were wrong with Professor Toshida Suda's thyroid study. Right. So what did I, you know, I said, and we were all, this is going on in the Japan Times over 3 or 4 days. You know, we were really at it. And so basically we turned around and I said, look, I'm going to contact Professor Suda and I'm going to put these to him and we'll get a response. Now, it's too long to put on the Japan Times, so I'll put it onto my blog and I'll send you the link to the blog. And, you know, Japan Times, fair play to them. They kept the thing open. Because I could see we were having a good argument about, you know, is there children's thyroid cancer caused by radiation or not, all right? So anyway, I did contact him, and I sent him an email once again. And then basically he turned around and he responded within 2 days. Within 2 days, okay? So, you know, every single point that they made, basically, he rebutted. He rebutted it really well, nice and clearly and concisely. He was Japanese, but he was able to, in English, write all this down, and I was able to sort of make a blog post on it, you know, and it got 50 hits. But at the end of the day, it was great. So, and this guy, I think it was called Sam McGill, or I don't know if that's his real name. This is the nuclear health physicist from the USA, who you'll often see these guys on, The Guardian every time they have a nuclear story or whatever.
Yeah, the pro-nuclear. They make a point of looking and making comments about how.
I'm dealing with three of them on the Japan Times. But anyway, so I got the response. I put it up, and then they came back and goes, oh, well, no, that's not right. And then they put up a load of others. Now, of course, the clever thing here was that if I hadn't said anything, they would have waited 6 months, sent him those 8 points. He would have rebutted them. They'd have waited another 2 months or something, or 3 months or 6 months. And then they'd have given him another load of questions. But here's the thing. They actually gave me all the next round of questions. This is what they do when you're trying to do a peer review study. You know, they just delay it for years and just keep hitting you with these questions after questions, you know, about the, you know, oh, look, you put a full stop in the wrong place. You did this, you did that. And then they have to go away, rewrite it, resubmit it. And that's how the peer review process works. But what had happened was, is that I was able, within a few days, able to give Professor Suda the arguments from the nuclear industry, which he hadn't got yet. And then their response was another 10 points, and I sent him those. But the point is, though, I didn't ask for a rebuttal, but it was really just to say, look, there you are, you've got 18 arguments they would have used on you over the next year or so. Well, you can answer them now, and then they have to just dig around and find more things, which was making Professor Suda's sort of study very strong, but it was quickening the process of the peer review, you know. So that,
well, I have to say, I've never really engaged on any of those blogs, like on ENE News, or I don't like to put comments down. Yeah. You know, mostly I just, to be honest, the reason I don't is I don't think we convince anybody out there. I think we're just, you know, they're paid to stick to the point.
Yeah.
And honestly, this was my point to Dana, and I have to say, I think it kind of made him mad, was that I said, no matter what we do, no matter who's saying what, we have not changed their mind one bit. The train, Germany is now going to pay the nuclear industry money because they won in court for lost compensation. We are building nuclear power plants in India, in China. They are happening. The United States is building nuclear power plants. The United States is increasing money for its nuclear. Our efforts, you know, we're failing. Let's just be real. They're not hearing us. Their fingers are in their ears. They're like, la, la, la.
I have to say one thing here. Is that, and I'll use the UK as an example. Now, in 2013, right, the five big insurance companies basically turned around, and they had invested $350 billion into nuclear over the, because they started a big campaign in the UK about 2005. It was to do with MOX fuel and all this type of stuff, and promoting nuclear and everything else. And what they did, of course, the insurance companies, they invested $350 billion. Now, by 2013, because of what bloggers were doing, not just me, but, you know, yourself and everybody else, any time you post anything up on the internet, it was being picked up by the financial blogs. And it was, and instead of just having, and we'll come back to the who's behind the Science Daily articles and why that comes out. But they were basically turned around. They basically realized that the nuclear industry was a dead duck. So the insurance companies pulled the money out, $350 billion in the UK, and then they invested it in something called a PFI contract, which was basically building roads and schools. But they're very lucrative. So over 40 years, you get 10 times, up to 10 times the money you put in. So that's 10 times $350 billion they were going to get. Now, when they pulled the money out of the nuclear industry, the tax man put the money in. Okay, to cover it. Okay, so that's the mechanism. So it doesn't matter if the banks are if somebody's suing the government for this or that. Nuclear is a dead duck, in my opinion, and it's getting more dead by the day. And you know, the big insurance company, the big investors,
along with us, Sean. That's the point. It's
The big investment into TEPCO. Was a Norwegian investor. They pulled their money out after nearly year one. It was by year two. They pulled their money out of TEPCO with loss, right? Because they know that it's a dead duck. Now, what's happening is, so how comes it still going, you may ask? Well, the reason it's still going is because of companies, and this particular company was involved in the BP Gulf oil spill, Fukushima disaster. They work for the governments to basically minimize the damage, right, to the nuclear industry. And how they did that was that it's called WPP LLC. Look them up. And we did quite a few articles on nuclear news about it. And then what they would do is that they would manage, and I've done articles on the BP Gulf oil spill, and their name cropped up there as well.
WPP?
WPP LLC, right? So basically, the guy in charge is called, guy called Sir Martin Sorrell. And so they would basically Prime Minister Abe and say, look, we'll manage this for you. So what you would see, that they had advertising, newspaper contracts, that they had the money. They would give them to the newspapers and all the rest of it. They had top-notch solicitors. They had security companies hassling the locals, and they did in Louisiana, and they did in Fukushima. And then the next little thing, which you might have noticed in the first year, was the buy your radioactive carrot from Fukushima, you know, and all this kind of campaigns they did. And they're doing tourism campaigns at the moment, and they go worldwide, you know. So if you click on Fukushima at certain times, you'll just see, oh, Fukushima, go there on holiday, or buy their food, or look, sake, you know. And they have drives, you know. And there's one company behind that. In this case, it's WPP LLC. There are other PR companies, you know, who also are involved. They're all sort of like a little buddy network. WPP LLC. Well, let me explain this about the PR companies. In the last recession in 1980 or whatever it was, the PR companies were going out of business because people didn't advertise, right? They didn't have the money to advertise. So they were cutting back and selling buildings and all the rest of it. After Fukushima, their profits went up, right? Because they were getting money from the government. All right, it's more taxpayers' money from Japan or from USA, if it was Louisiana, or in the case of UK, you know, you've got other UK-based and WPP are probably involved, and in Ireland with Shell Oil and all the rest of it. They basically come in and they manage the situation. And that is a quote from Sir Martin Sorrell, by the way. They manage the situation for the government, and that's what's behind it. So who's behind Science Media Daily? Who's the funder? WPP, LLC, and companies like that. So at the end of the day, they've got security companies that can go, you know, following people around, hassling journalists, dogging doctors that are trying to speak up about it, and all this kind of thing. So that's the mechanism. But all they're doing is just like, it's like a sort of like a nice sweet icing over a pile of can I say dog shit? I hope I can. But anyway, that's what it is. And they're very good at doing it. And their profits have gone up and up and up and up. And in fact, they're much more in use now, you know, because obviously there's all this war with Syria and everything else. So they're trying to manage the situation again, you know. Anyway, I won't go into that because the evidence, you know, is starting to come out, and you can blog, you know, blog away and check out what's going on. But it's all the same thing. I mean, the PR companies is really a propaganda company now, and the money is paid for by taxpayers around the world. And
that's the whole thing. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
This is why I talk about it all the time, because we're really just dealing with propaganda. That's really, we're being propagandized and gaslit to extinction.
Yeah, but obviously you have to realize that the financial companies, what they do when they have on the internet, for instance, they have web trawling bots, if you want to call it that, and that, which automatically go around getting all the news. So like for nuclear news, we put up 10 posts a day. That's just one blog. Right. And we put these 10 posts up, and it's usually with pithy headlines like nuclear is dead, or, you know, sort of, the, you know, confirming the Toshida Suda thyroid study and all this kind of thing. And it counters the stuff that WPP are putting out, you know, like proof that radiation is good for you kind of thing. And what the financial companies do, they balance up the evidence. You know, they look into it, they balance up the evidence. How many anti-nuclear sort of stories to pro-nuclear? And if there's more anti-nuclear stories, you basically turn around and they divest. They take the money out. And that's exactly what's happening. So what we're finding is that the tax...
I don't think it's just because of the stories. It's because of the reality. I mean, well, just look what happened just this week in the United States. The WIPP fell apart. 8-inch thick piece of the ceiling, the two-thirds the size of a football field, collapsed in the United States.
Yeah, and you know, but the thing is that in terms of the financial industry, they're not aware of that unless somebody says it. Now, if one article in one paper for one day comes out and says it and then disappears, their bots will pick up on that, because afterwards you'll always see a load of really, you know, during Chernobyl and all that, the anniversary during the Fukushima anniversary, the BBC was running there's nothing wrong with radiation. And that's been completely debunked. And Geraldine Thomas, once again, who was over there doing this ridiculous video, they actually had to pull it in the end, the BBC. And it's been debunked by top scientists, you know, even people that you might even consider pro-nuclear. They turned around and said what she was saying there was dangerous. She wanted young, you know, children to move back into highly radioactive areas. And in fact, actually, she couldn't even measure the radiation. You know, she couldn't count, basically. But even so, afterwards, she said, well, there's still no problem. But at the end of the day, what she was saying was dangerous, you know. So, but for the BBC, they did that story, but there was a lot of anti-nuclear stuff going on at the time. And then since then, she's been completely debunked. And she was, you know, going back to the British nuclear test veterans who have children that are born with disabilities because of the nuclear test dust that fell on top of them. Basically, she was there. She was the UK expert in the court case, you know, and she was being debunked, and they had to pull the video on the BBC because it was so wrong. They did it quietly. I mean, I noticed it. I was one of the people that complained about it. But there was some really good, top-notch people that are into nuclear energy. But they said that she was completely wrong, even by their standards. Okay, so there's a huge fight going on. And in fact, actually, if I can mention the British nuclear test veterans, there's a court case on there. And you had Chris Busby on one side and Geraldine Thomas on the other. And it was finalized in around about August, a bit before maybe. But the bottom line was, though, after it finished, we should have had the judge should have sat down and said, right, we're going to, you know, in 6 weeks' time, I'll give you my judgment. It's about 6 weeks it takes to do the judgment, because he's been looking at all the evidence. It takes him 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. That's where Chris Busby was actually the attorney. He couldn't go in as a witness. Expert, but he could go in as an attorney.
Yeah, there was four other experts that went in.
So what happened with that? What did happen?
What happened with that is that we're still waiting. You know, this is like over 3 months mm-hmm. later. Mm-hmm. We're still waiting. And but what I will say, I found out, was that the Ministry of Defence, who represented Geraldine Thomas, actually made a representation afterwards, after the case had been finished. Now, okay, that's a bit unusual, but okay, so they made that, because they know they're losing it. So, but they made that. And then Chris found out about it. He said, well, look, I need to answer that. And the Ministry of Defence went to the judge and said, look, you can't get, you know, you can't allow him to respond to this new evidence we've got. And he did anyway. The judge said, yeah, no, you can, because by law, if you bring in some stuff after the court case, then the defence, you know, the other side have to be able to rebut it, you know. So that did happen. But now, well, you know, it's just waiting and waiting and waiting. And now, of course, we've got in England, they brought in some really draconian sort of laws. They can be spied on, they can hack your phone, they can get in. They've been doing this anyway, by the way, but that's another story. But basically, and we can't talk about it until the court case is resolved, but there'll be some really interesting information from Chris and myself, actually, because I witnessed some stuff, actually, while I was there. But the bottom line is, though, is that we're waiting to see what the result will be from this. But now that, you know, the judge can be hacked, you know, his phone can be, you know, and they can probably put on heavy pressures and all this is going on behind the scenes. The Ministry of Defence is very powerful. And they've got the Tory government backing them up to the hilt, you know, pro Trident has built some nuclear weapons to defend itself from the evil Russians, you know, and all this sort of nonsense. So basically that's what's going on. And you know, the fact that the judge didn't turn around after 6 weeks and say, yes, we'll find in favor of the defendants the British nuclear test veterans and their families for, you know, 20 generations or and more, but they haven't. And neither have they turned around. And
well, what's the turnaround time in British courts? I know
six weeks.
Oh, it is. Here, you see, you're looking at a standard. Normally in the United States, a case like that would take 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, the case itself has been going on, and it's been there's all sorts of shenanigans, which are just too long to go into here. But basically, it's been going on for about, you know, a decade or more.
Wow.
And it's so this was the final, this year was the final, and the information was clearly set out, but what it is, of course, is that, you know, how can the judge, you know, this is my own personal opinion, you know, this has nothing to do with Chris's, I don't know what Chris thinks about this or whatever, this is my own personal opinion just looking at it from the side, but how can the judge take the word of Geraldine Thomas, who's known to be not a nuclear expert at all, even though the BBC promotes her, and I will tell you why the BBC promotes her, right? In my opinion, is the fact that there's something called the Science Media Centre, and in America there's something called Sense About Science, and it comes back to why I started doing this all in the first place. Now, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if you went into a degree course in science media journalism, you'd learn how to be a journalist, but you'd also do another module, which would be learning how, about the science. So you'd have science modules, and you'd learn how to be able to read a study that's been done, like Timothy Museau or Tashi Suda, and you'd read it, and you'd contact them like I did, and they'd give you a response, and you'd be able to rebut what's being said, and you'd be able to do a balanced sort of article on it. And that, we used to get that, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Now what happens is, I was talking to a young man who was doing from Japan, who was doing a science media journalist course. Now what happens is they actually go, they're not taught to do that. They're taught to go to the Science Media Center experts, who are all, you know, Science Media Center is a charity, and it's paid for by the likes of EDF, you know, the British Nuclear Fuels, SATO as well.
IAEA, no doubt.
Not the IAEA, no, but certainly EDF and many other sort of nuclear energy suppliers. And
I went to this page that you just mentioned, Sense About Science. There's a thing on here that says post-truth debate.
Oh, yeah, they'd be into post-truth without a doubt.
Transparency of evidence.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But see, what Science Media Center do is they go to the newspapers and to the media outlets, and they say, look, you don't want to sort of talk to these independent journalists, and you know what you need to do is talk to the experts, because they know what's up. You know, we have the right science. Now, the whole point about science is that if you've got a theory, you know, you've got a theory that radiation is good or bad for you, it's a theory. And it never becomes a fact, because in science it stays a theory, and, you know, basically the theory is argued over time. Okay, so that is what science is about.
This is what this link says. So, this was printed December 2nd, 2016. New standards published today by the Cabinet Office will ensure that grants will be effectively managed across the government. There's a new set of standards for granting the standards.
Yeah, but the point is, it's all to do with this control. You know, sort of corporate control, if you like, off the media and the outlets. That's why we come up with silly sort of headlines that radiation is benefiting the birds in Chernobyl, for instance. You know, and the scientist who did the paper said, no, that's not right. That's really taking it out of context. You know, So the bottom line is that they don't even care what the scientists say. They just read a bit of the actual journal, the article that's in the journal, that's peer reviewed, and they'll just take the bit out they want. They'll cherry pick. And, mm-hmm. and that is very much a PR thing, going back to WPP LLC and Science Media Center, which I've written on extensively in nuclearnews.net. And others have as well. In Australia, somebody who was a proper science media journalist in Australia turned around and said, "Well, I can't do this anymore, because at the end of the day, all I do is I get sued, or my editors turn around to me and say, 'Well, look, we've got to let you go, you know, if you're gonna write that story.'" So there's huge pressures. And so science media journalism, the real thing of it, you know, the going and looking at both sides and reading the actual scientific data and coming up with the truth, or near as the truth as we can find, it doesn't happen anymore, you know. So that's really why I got into what I'm doing, is because, you know, I haven't done a degree in journalism, but I have a background in science. I'm an engineer, so at the end of the day, it did take a bit of time to get around, the nuclear industry and its little shenanigans, especially when you're looking at epidemiology, you're looking at atmospheric dispersion and what have you. And of course, because I've been covering all these different aspects of the nuclear industry, you know, the actual nuclear workers that read my blog and read other blogs that are similar. They basically go there because they know that if you work in the nuclear industry, you work in a very small area, you know. So for instance, if you're one of the guys that go out testing things, yeah, you know about that, but you don't know about the technical stuff that's going on, or releases that are going on necessarily in the nuclear industry. And the same way, if you're working in the nuclear power plant, you don't necessarily know what's coming out and what damage stuff that's coming out of the stacks of a nuclear power plant and the other releases through water, like tritium and all this other stuff. So at the end of the day, that's kind of what it really is neat.
Do you spend a lot of time doing blogging? It sounds like you do spend a lot of time blogging and posting. And
sure.
I mean, it's kind of like a part-time job for you, isn't it?
Well, to be honest, there's been times, you know, where it's been a full-time job. And, you know, I think, you know, I'm obviously, I got chased out of the UK, basically, a long story. Maybe we'll cover it one day. But I moved back to Ireland, and you know, it's where my family were from, and I thought it was a safe place. It was number 7 on the Press Freedom Index, and whereas the UK's 40, and I think the US is 70 or something. You know, it's way
down. Yeah, it's not so much. I have to say, it's interesting because, like a lot of with your blogs, I mean, as an American, I'll be very frank with you. I don't respond because I don't want our government to know what I'm thinking.
Exactly. I mean, we have some of the quietest.
I mean, it's really bad, but
we have some of the quietest comments, you know, sections. We never get any Japanese commenting. They do read and they do take it in.
Mm-hmm.
They won't comment because there's a Japanese secrets law.
And I'm just not going to comment. I don't want to be chased after because I'm standing up for the right thing on a newspaper, because the people that are going to attack me, they're paid to do it, and they really, honestly, they have no regard for human life. As far as I'm concerned, they're all genociders.
I've had a few arguments, well, quite a lot. I've had stacks. I've had hundreds of arguments.
Have you convinced any of them? Have you convinced anybody to, like, turn from their ways of evil and protecting? I mean, in my view, nuclear is unequivocally evil.
I'll claim one recent victory I had. It was on the Canary, and they did a nuclear story. It's an English journal, and they had a nuclear story. They're usually sort of left-wing sort of politics stuff, but they put one up every now and again. And they're actually advised by the Science Media Center. They have to be because of something called the Leveson Inquiry. But anyway, that's a long story. I engaged somebody. Well, I actually made a comment, and then that comment came as, no, there's no health effects from radiation. And so we got into it, and I did about 40 comments. But I ended up having a fight on that one. It wasn't too bad. There was only two of the pro-nuclears. There's one American, and there's one somebody from the UK. And we were doing this for 2 or 3 or 4 days, because this is how they work. So, but anyway, I was engaged with it. I knew my arguments, And one example of an argument, and I was saying, well, Timothy Musso has done 70 peer-reviewed articles that prove that there's damage from radiation. You know, they turned around and said, oh, Timothy Musso, let me look that up on Wikipedia. Oh, he's anti-nuke, so it doesn't count. And I said, well, what you're saying to me then is that 70 peer-reviewed articles do not count. Is that correct? You know, and I was having an argument with two of them. Anyway, we went on and on, and I was showing them links, and I was saying, look, there you are. There's his peer-reviewed articles, da-da-da-da. And in the end, one of them turned around and said, well, actually, maybe both of you were right. That was the English guy, actually. The American one was just adamant that there couldn't be anything wrong with any health effects of radiation. But the English guy, he started off...
This is the thing. Have they just completely ignored all the work from Dr. Linus Pauling, Dr. John Goffman?
They would never,
Goffman.
Ever read that, because they'd do a quick Wikipedia Google and find out he's anti-nuke and then just dismiss it. You know, the fact that you've got peer-reviewed articles that, by the way, to peer-review one article, you will have all these people. At the moment, for instance, to see Toshida Tsuda in Japan, who's doing this thyroid study, if you go on to his online article, you know, his online journal report, which is absolutely free. Anybody can look at it and read the whole thing. You know, it's commercial Creative Commons. And if you look at it, you can see you can see about five people are arguing with him, right, on this, you know, on various points. And they'll be doing this for about 2 or 3 years, and they're paid very well to do it. One of them is a guy called Richard Wakeford, and Richard Wakeford is the guy who actually gives Geraldine Thomas her advice on epidemiology and dose. Okay,
wow.
So it's a wicked web we weave. Now, in fairness to Richard,
Let me interrupt you. Do you have this book by Dr. John Goffman? It's called "Radiation from Medical Procedures and the Pathogens of Cancer and Ischemic Heart Disease."
No. When I left the UK, I was earning when I got into this, I was earning £800 a week. I presume that.
Well, look. When we're off of
dollars,
there, send,
and I had
send,
books, and I had a home, and everything
I'll
else.
Send you
when
this
I left,
book.
I just let me when I left the
book.
UK, I basically picked up two bags, right, and I left all my other possessions. And when I came to Ireland, I had two bags in my hands, and one there was somebody from Any News who actually paid for a hotel for me for a couple of weeks, and then there's a whole story behind that as well. But at the end of the day, no, I don't have any books.
Well, I'm going to send you this book. I want you to send me your address off the air. I'll mail you this book. I get them all the time to mail out to people who can understand the science, because it's all this data. Dr. Goffman has the data. He went to extensive work trying to get the data in writing, in books. It's here. We don't need to beat an old dead horse. We already know it's harmful. Low-dose radiation is harmful, and it's scientifically proven in the 50s and 60s, and there are books written that are available on the net, at least for me, for like $5-$10. They're not very expensive.
I will say, you don't need to do that, because at the end of the day, there's new evidence come out. And one of the really interesting things I might as well mention is that it's quite interesting, actually, is in 1970, well, the Hiroshima study, which all this dose thing is based on, the ICRP dose model, which is used in hospitals and in nuclear accidents and everything else, is basically based on a study of epidemiology on the survivors of the Hiroshima bombing, all right, the Hiroshima mm-hmm. bomb. Now, in 1973, the nuclear industry looked at it, and they said, oh, the control. Now, in epidemiology, you have a control group, which is a group living in a clean area, and you have the actual information from people that were in the dirty area where the radiation is. Now, what they did, they looked at it, said, oh, that Japanese control group, they're way too healthy. And so what they did, they scrapped the control group, moved it over to a more radiation soaked people, and then redid the epidemiological study, which meant that the actual damage from radiation was hidden. Okay, and I've got a lot of examples of this. I mean, in Polydactyl, in Chernobyl, the Western version is that there's not much difference in Polydactyl. There is a little bit, but not much. In the Russian study, right? And they only, in the Western study, they only deal in percentages, by the way, not numbers. Now, in the Russian study, they deal in numbers, okay? And I looked at the two of them, and I realized that the Russian study was done over a 10-year period. And basically, for the first 7 years, it was quite manky. It reduced. And after 10 years, basically, you could see, and this is after, you know, after Chernobyl, you could see that there was quite a big drop-off, right? The Western study, right, was done over 15 years, okay, and only included percentages. Now, you could see how that might, you know, so they're basically, they stuck on another 5 years of where there was very little polydactyl. And so, therefore, when they sort of looked at the whole thing, you know, they could say, oh, well, there's hardly any difference. Whereas the Russian study would turn around and say, well, actually, you know, there was a significant difference. You know, and in terms of epidemiology, that's a big thing. But in terms of numbers, the numbers, oddly enough, worked out there was about 50 children a year initially born with polydactyl after Chernobyl. And there should only be 2 or 3 per 100,000. Okay, but there was actually 50 altogether in that area, and it's quite a large area. But I think it was the sort of area of Belarus where it was badly hit, and some of Ukraine and some of Russia. So they looked at those numbers, and they turned around and they said, well, look, you know, the cases of polydactyl are actually 50 a year, and funnily enough, that's what we had for the first 2 years after Japan. Okay, so, you know, all I'm saying is you go back there in 10 years' time, there'd probably be, you know, 10 or 5, you know, per 100,000, you know. And so you can really play with the figures. And all you've got to do is extend the amount of time if you know that there's a short-lived effect.
The other part of all of this, too, is we have not lived 8 or 9 generations as animal species have done. You know what I mean? Like, Helen Caldicott reiterates this all the time. We don't really see the real worst of the mixes don't come in until many generations later. And because of the way it works in our DNA, it may skip a few generations, but then it'll get progressively worse. It's an unknown, and it is a killer. That's the whole issue, is that we're really messing with something that ought not to be messed with, period.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I think they should shut them down, you know, because there's use.
We also need scientists to start spending money on how to solve it and how to fix it. Sean, we have about 7 minutes left. I just want to kind of give you that heads up. We've been on the show now, for almost done. So is there
any other points you want to mention? Or
that's what I was about to ask you. Is there anything that you really wanted to talk about? Like, I think it's important for us to, this has been the good part about since post-Fukushima. It not only woke up Fukushima and rattled those nuclear power plants and blew them up and created the worst catastrophe on the planet. That's still ongoing. It's actually woken up a lot of people like myself who really had no idea and no concept. I actually believed the government before Fukushima that everything was perfectly fine. Now I'm kind of having my Scooby-Doo moments all the time, like, for real, is it that bad? And so I really think we need to organize, and we need to organize around a theory of love. Like, we need, I really believe that if we're going to get through this time, we have got to, the reason that we're doing it is we love our planet. The reason we can't forget about this is because we love our children. We want our species to thrive.
Well, we do have a lot of problems coming our way, whether it's climate change or radiation from nuclear power plants or accidents and many other things. But I would say to people, you know, if they can, open a blog up and just blog up titles, because I believe this works. And, I really do believe this works, by the way, that if you get, you don't have to get any hits on your blog. All you've got to do is you've got to put a title up and let those web bots pick it up, and the financial industry will pull away from nuclear even more than it has already. And there's loads of evidence that the financial industry has said, no, this is a bad bet. Now, that does leave it with the taxpayer, but the fact is that the taxpayer is the one that's going to end up with it. But let's get the corporations out of the picture. Let's take it over. Let's pay the tax to clean it up, close it down, because we're stuck with that anyway. And then, you know, and it's an unfortunate thing, you know, it's a big concept that the corporation.
Well, Sean, why don't you talk a little bit about the hashtags, how to get that out? Okay. We've got 5 minutes.
Okay. For you with, for those of you with Facebook or Twitter, if you have a story and you want to share it, make a nice punchy headline. But right at the start, stick in, I don't know, like, for instance, I did a hashtag earlier of TEPCO, hashtag TEPCO, hashtag, what's it, CBC, hashtag, what's it, the Japan Times. And when you go over to the hashtag Twitter page, when you Google it, you'll see your post up there. And it will go to the media, they will see it. It will go to TEPCO, they will see it. And, you know, certainly try and find out which Twitter pages are slower. Because, like, for instance, if you put one on Japan Times, you know, the Twitter feed's quite busy there. But if you put it on hashtag TEPCO, it'll lurk, it'll hang there. And of course, the people from TEPCO can read it. And, of course, anybody who's looking up the hashtag, like journalists or whatever, looking up the hashtag TEPCO sign can basically find it. And, you know, I do things like... hashtag UNHRC, you know, Human Rights Commission, hashtag in my case EUHRC, hashtag, well, absolutely ICRP, hashtag IAEA is quite a favourite one of mine at the moment. And it, what it is that journalists especially actually do use Twitter quite a lot. You know, it's Ask Donald Trump. And then basically, if you do your hashtags at the start of your Facebook page within 140 characters, the Google will pick it up and it will lodge it immediately onto the hash the page. And then, if you're a group of people, you want to stagger the sharing so that one day one of you puts it up, the other day another one puts it up. If it's an emergency thing, well, maybe you could do it an hour apart. There's loads of little trends that we can do, and you can share articles, anti-nuclear articles, you know, if you share them.
To force the media to actually pick this information
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely.
And start looking at it.
Otherwise, it's all left with alternate media and Donald
Trump.
That's
a great idea, Sean. Thank you for giving us that little idea. Now, is it a bad idea to put hashtag IAEA hates life? Will that still be picked up?
Yes, it will. It will. But it's much better to put hashtag IAEA and then something,
just leave that.
And then something a nice little short bit, because it's got to be 140 under 140,
right?
Some pithy headline like you'd find on any news, which will draw them towards the Facebook page or towards your Twitter account. And you can hashtag videos and all sorts, and they'll go into the hashtag Twitter videos section and all sorts of things like that.
You should put out a video on your YouTube channel on how to do this and show people how it works.
Oh, well, if I get time, I will.
Twitter. Like, how do you use Twitter? Like, that's one of the things. I'm on Twitter, but I don't quite get how to access a lot of it or how to use it. But I do know that when I post and push hashtags up, I do get a lot more. I have quite a few followers just from having done that.
Of course. Well, Twitter is massive at the moment. But for me, obviously I don't really go for hits. The people who follow me, they're scientists and journalists and things like that. So I try to make the stuff I'm doing very clear to them. You know, I only have 250 friends on Facebook, you know, Carl Grossman being one, actually. But there is other scientists and actors and activists, you know, that
well, Sean, why don't you tell our listeners how to find your work? We've got a minute and a half left.
Well, I've got a little project I'm working on, which is called European News Weekly, all one word, .wordpress.com. And thing I'm just putting little bits and bobs up, and it's to do with my situation, you know, little bits of unfairness I see around me. You'll find articles about Sellafield and little cover-up.
We have a minute left, so where
okay.
else?
And I'd also say it's nuclear-news.net, obviously. I don't post on there too much, but I'm doing a lot of the research behind it. And Herve is picking that up, and Christina picks it up, and of course they're doing their own research as well. I find that is a very useful blog to check once a day. You know, you get your 10 posts and you can quickly whip through it and just see what's going on.
Okay, so we have like 45 seconds. Any other way to get in touch with you?
Yep, you've got Arclight 2011, which is my YouTube channel where I was doing UK nuclear pollution. and NO2, which is a big issue, and lead and things like that. And you can check that out. And I've also put some interviews I've done for a wide range of people, which is on there as well, ArcLight 2011.
You've been listening with Lonnie Clark, the Age of Fission radio show. Put your courage feet on, take some action, it matters. Sean McGee has been our guest, and we will talk with you guys soon. Thank you for joining us. Talk to you later. Take Bye. Action.
This is Gene.